Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Oh, I am recording this on Mojave, which is probably a mistake, but if you're hearing this, dear listeners, it worked.
Well, yeah, that I guess that would be the only way to find out.
Yeah, I guess. I've been rebooting into High Sierra, but I upgraded my regular Mac to Mojave, so now it's the High Sierra's on the external drive, which is fine. But that's a, 5-minute process to go over there. And I decided for this podcast, just as I let the laundry run, just am not going to reboot. And we're going to just try out Call Recorder in, it seems to be working. It looks all messed up, but it seems to be working. So,
yeah, well, such is the way of betas. I've been using it on my laptop, which is not my primary recording machine.
That's good. Cause a lot of the Rogue Amoeba stuff doesn't work. So,
yeah.
Oh
well. It's fine.
They'll get it together by the time it ships. I mean, I can't hold it against any software developer whose software is not currently compatible with the next version of the OS that isn't out until the fall.
Frankly, I had to use a Skype track for the Rebound episode I posted today because Lex's track was all messed up doing that crazy thing where it like speeds everything, like the clock speeds are off or something.
Yeah,
so like I was like,
where he talks fast for 28 seconds and then there's 2 seconds of silence.
Blips. It had like weird blips in it too. It was funny too because I lined up in Logic, here's your track and here's the Skype track, here's you doing the same minute ad read, and in one like it's clearly half as long as the other. It's very strange.
It's not good. I've been there. I've seen that. That's not good.
Nothing to do about it but use the Skype track, and at least the Skype track was intelligible. So
podcast,
you roll with it.
Secrets revealed here.
Yeah, this is what the podcast pros do.
Did you see my thing about my charts? My Apple Financial charts.
Yeah, your charts all programmatic now. Fancy.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to put the numbers in the spreadsheet, but then I've got a script I can run that will export it all out, and I detail it. But it's like, this is what user automation was built for. And in fact, I realized that there's two reasons that this is good. One is it will save me time, right? Eventually, the work I put into it will come back to me in terms of saved time. But also, and it was drudgery, like, let me tell you, taking a screenshot of every single thing and making sure that you got the crosshairs right so that it's not cutting off text and stuff like that. It was just a pain. But it also means that they'll all go up way faster.
Right, right. Well, it was interesting because I was reading your breakdown of it, and I had just recently created a really basic automator action that's kind of similar because I was putting together this photo book for my mom's 75th birthday, and I got some cousins to scan in some photos because I didn't have access to, older photos, before I was born. And one of my cousins scanned in a bunch from my aunt, but she ended up basically having a PDF where they were all on separate pages. And so I had like a 20-page PDF of photos. And I was like, I could go through and save these all out one at a time, because it turns out Preview doesn't let you just, save these all out as separate files.
Yeah.
But you can make a quick automator action using the sort of the same render PDF to image thing. And I just like ran that, dropped the, PDF on it, and it spat out a bunch of, JPEGs or whatever I wanted at the resolution I wanted, etc., which was pretty great.
Yeah, it's funny how putting my thing together was definitely the pieces, right? So it was I needed a piece to get out a high resolution thing. And it's like, oh well, Sal Segovian has a script for that basically automates the export to PDF, which you can do by hand, but like export a numbers document to PDF. And then there's that automator block that says take a PDF and make it into, and you're like a ping at 300 DPI or whatever you want. And then it does that and it spits out files. And then there's a script after that that crops those files. And that file, because it's one big file with every single chart on it. And then basically I had to normalize my charts because they were all sort of slightly different sizes. And so I made a little box that was like chart size, and then I held it over each one of them in turn and was like, oh, you're a little tall, you're a little wide, and just kind of like get everything to fit in the boxes. And then also put a bunch of guides on the page so that I could, so I wanted everyone to sort of start at the same level and basically make rows and columns of the charts, because that allowed me to write a script that basically I feed in the coordinates, which I had to measure in Photoshop, but I feed in the coordinates and then I do two loops. So it loops through every column, and then in each column, it loops through each row, and those are X, Y coordinates basically. So it goes do, 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 do. Okay, do, 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 and it just does that for all of them, and every single one, it's outputting a ping at a and resizing them on the fly, and it totally worked. It Image Magic is what I had to use, which is a set of command line tools, most popular I think on servers, but it runs on my Mac fine. I use Homebrew to install it because I have Homebrew installed, which is like a package manager for. You install all sorts of command line stuff. Yep. But that was, I was hoping for like an automator action that was just like, give it coordinates and a size and have it crop. Yeah. And I do have one, but it's an old one that doesn't work anymore. It was using an old version of Photoshop that is no longer compatible with anything like that. So I finally found Image Magic and I was like, all right, if I can do it, because I knew there would be something. And I asked Dr. Drang about it, and he said Image Magic is your answer. And
I was trying to remember if that was the same tool I used way back, something maybe similar, but like way back when I was still a developer, I was building these web portals for the research program I worked at, and I put together this whole stats package where it would take, you know, read like an Apache log or something and generate pretty graphs based on it, like programmatic. Again, like it was all like a program package.
I don't know if it does that one, but although there are tools to do that.
Something
too.
Like that.
Yeah. So, but anyway, so it worked. So now I can have my numbers file open and put in all of the numbers in a couple of weeks when the results come out on the 31st, I think, of July. And I double click a thing and wait a minute. Maybe 2 minutes, and at that point all of the charts will have been exported and uploaded to the Six Colors website, and the HTML including all of them will be on my clipboard. It's like, all right, that works. And that was I was able to do that. That was pretty awesome. So let's hear it for automation. And I will say it would be nice if that stuff was way more accessible, like in the app, right? Like if I could group each chart together and chart and text and stuff and reference them and choose to export them one by one, like there could be other ways of doing it, but that's just not how it works. So instead,
you know, it's interesting. I've been using Numbers and Pages in Keynote a lot in the last couple of weeks for a variety of different tasks, and they're pretty good. But every once in a while, you do run into these weird like roadblocks where it's like, oh man, I wish there was a more efficient way of doing this. And they're Apple's own apps, right? So like, you know, there's nobody else to complain to.
Yeah. What else is going on?
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say I wrote a thing on Macworld this week about the Apple rulebook. Which has been percolating for a little while, and it's just the idea that it actually sprung mostly from a conversation that I had, I think, with Mike Hurley about workflow and how when Apple bought workflow, everybody was like, "Oh, well, you know what's going to happen? They're going to, you know, break it down, use it for parts. It's going to disappear and all that." And it never happened. Like workflow stayed on the store. It's still in the store. And Siri Shortcuts and the Shortcuts app are very clearly workflow and then built on beyond that. Not workflow influenced, but like literally it's workflow with stuff added to it. And that was a good example of Apple doing something that it's very easy for people to say, oh, well, Apple's not going to do that. Like, that's not what Apple does. Apple always behaves in this way. And I think there was a period where that was pretty much true, because I think Jobs came back in 97 and was like, all right, this place is messed up. Here's how we're going to do it. And he built a new corporate culture. But in the last 5 years, I think Apple has rethought a bunch of that stuff. And I think some of it is just the fact that, you know, it worked for them for so long, and if you're somebody like Steve Jobs, you're like, okay, you know, we got this running, let's just leave it here. And when he was sick and all of that, I think especially people are like, well, we're not going to reverse any of the edicts of Steve Jobs, right? But with him gone, and a lot of the people that a lot of people don't know, but a lot of key sort of lieutenants of his also kind of dropped out of the organization after a little while. Katie Cotton, the head of communications, being the most obvious one, I think, for us. The people who were there are like, let's do things differently. And that's Tim Cook, but it's also people like Phil Schiller, and who was there a long time, but it was like he was clearly open to this. And Steve Dowling, who is the head of PR now and works for Phil Schiller, I believe, you know, he's made things very different there. And so you see it in acquisition, you see it in communication, the fact that they took Matthew Panzerino in a van, right? I mean, like...
He just grabbed him off the street, put a hood over his head,
threw him in an Apple Maps van, and off they went. Yeah, exactly. Like, they would not have... somebody can cite an example, but I don't think Apple's ever done something where they've literally taken one journalist and given them a complete access, or, you know, what seemingly complete, not actually complete, but like access to a topic, and then a story emerges from that. They used to do like limited, like David Pogue and Walt Mossberg and some other, Stephen Levy got like a product,
or something,
but it was not the
like
same.
Where I was thinking about the time with all the iPhone 4 antenna gate thing, right? Where it's like a small group of journalists taken to address a particular subject, right?
Where they let us all into the anechoic chamber, they couldn't hear our screams.
Spin. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. But this is actually quite remarkable, and not
right. That was
not
unusual
on their playbook, because they were trying to really spin their way out of that one. But it's different now, and I think that's the genesis of me writing that article, was basically to say, if somebody tells you, oh well, Apple wouldn't do that, I don't believe it, because that's not what Apple does. Bring skepticism to that, because we are in an era now where Apple is kind of left and right doing stuff that they didn't do before. I other examples I didn't mention in the article, like WWDC is a great example, where first off, they went back to San Jose, which was breaking a pattern. But second, you know, it used to be that they like aggressively went after anybody who tried to do events around WWDC, because it was we want to be the center of attention. Nobody else. AltConf can't exist. Like, nobody else. And now they promote events around WWDC, right?
Well, even the relaxing of the strictures around talking about beta stuff, right? Like, you know,
great example.
All this stuff over the years has changed a lot. And I think, you know, to the credit of both the people who are still there and, you know, people like the late Steve Jobs, I think, you know, even Jobs would have said, and more or less, I think probably did say, you know, don't try to keep running this company the way I would have run it.
I think he did say that.
Yeah, exactly. Run it the way that you're going to run it. So like, that makes sense.
But it was one of those things where he had to be gone.
I think, absolutely.
For some of that stuff to be there. And also, like, again, some of the other people around him had to be gone, because sometimes just turnover is the thing that, you know, you get the opportunity to rethink things. And like, if I'm running something, I run a certain way, and there's some decisions I make that I'm going to just kind of let go. I'm going to let them roll, because I got other stuff to do.
You got to clear some undergrowth in order to let the new plants
exactly
grow.
Somebody new comes in, and they're like, let's look at this and see if there's some things we should do. I think that's what happened with Steve Dowling taking over for Katie Cotton, is basically that, which is, you know, I don't think we're saying Katie Cotton did a bad job.
No, but she had a style,
and I think she and Steve, she had a style that was very conducive to sort of Steve's approach, and they worked on it, and they had a system. And then, you know, you get really efficient by saying, this is our playbook, this is how we're going to do this. Working with Steve, working with Phil Schiller, she's like, here's how we're going to handle the press, you know, like this. And then Steve Dowling rolls in, and it's like, well, now it's Tim Cook. And Phil Schiller's still there, and it's a new era, and media is different. It's not newspapers and news magazines anymore. It's websites and people who do videos on YouTube and stuff like that. And like, let's revisit this. Why not revisit it? And you see all the different ways that they've revisited how they approach that stuff. So, you know, I'm not saying all bets are off, but I'm saying every bet is less of a sure thing than it used to be, because there's all sorts of stuff they're doing and trying. And, it's just a different world now. They're
right.
Trying new stuff.
I mean, and I think some of the, you know, looking at what you're talking about, and obviously the events of the last week with the whole MacBook Pro updates coming out, like, that's not totally new. Speed bumps did occur, you know, now and again in the old Apple too, right? Like, stuff where they would get released in press releases mostly. This time they did like bring in some media to look at it, but it also, you know, a lot of us had speculated something along those lines of like, you know, a second event happening later this year. And I think, you know, that is something Apple has done in the past.
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't necessarily be breaking the playbook to do that. But at the same time, you know, along those lines, you can't predict one way or the other, because now I look at that and think, yeah, I think they're unlikely to have two events now. But, you know, it could go either way. There's no way to predict it.
It could. Depends on what the story is. I mean, they definitely have done that. I find myself asking that question, too, is like, iPhone event, want to bring more attention to the Mac and the iPad by rolling them into that event? Do you not? I think one of my examples in my story was that thing, you know, last week with the MacBook Pros. People were so angry at WWDC that there were no new MacBook Pros announced. And I think undercutting a lot of the anger was this assumption that Apple would only release them at an event, and that there wouldn't be another event until September, and so there weren't going to be new MacBook Pros till September. I really think that a lot of people believe that. And the fact is, no. They did a briefing round. And released them.
Well, like, and a lot of people, I think, also expected... And this is gets into tricky areas, but right, like there's all this fuss and outcry over the keyboard issue, and I think a lot of people assumed, well, naturally Apple's move will be to totally redesign the keyboard and put out a new model with a new keyboard, and therefore it doesn't get announced at WWDC. It'll be such a big update that it won't get announced until a subsequent event. And of course, it's not what happened, because for a number of reasons, you know, they did revise the keyboard, and from all indications, they do seem to have taken some measures to prevent the kind of problems that have already happened. But because there are also legal actions ongoing about that, they can't come out necessarily and say, we've made this keyboard less fragile or less likely to break, right? Like that, they're kind of in a bind about that. So people were projecting what they thought, how they thought it would go. And I see this a lot too, right? Like you draw lines based on the dots that you can see. And a lot of times I think those lines are a little bit ridiculous because they are based on an imperfect understanding of exactly what happens. Like I saw a piece this morning talking about Apple, I think it was in Bloomberg, I think it was an op-ed about how Apple should be the EU should take on Apple next because of the same thing that they just took on Google for over the packaging of apps. And while there is some crossover there, it's a very different situation. And one of the pieces of evidence used to cite that was like, oh, the Supreme Court's going to hear this article or this case on the App Store being a monopoly. And I wrote something about this a couple weeks ago when that case came out, because that's exactly... you know, kind of, it's a bad interpretation of what that case actually is, which was just about whether or not a certain class of people had standing to bring a lawsuit, not whether or not the lawsuit would actually be about Apple's monopoly. So, you know, people draw these lines based on conclusions they've made from imperfect understandings of what is actually going on and how these companies and giant entities do business.
Also, the regulators can do whatever they want, but I'm amused by the fact that people talk about Apple and monopolistic practices, because Apple is what, 15% of the market?
I mean, right. Well, and that's the reason this article was arguing that it wasn't going to happen. And I don't think it necessarily will. I think there is a strong argument to be made about something like opening up default apps as an option. But and it's possible, entirely possible, that the EU could decide to make an argument about consumer choice on that.
Yeah,
entirely possible.
The problem I have with that is that that's like saying that automakers need to sell you cars with empty radio holes. Like, you know, Apple makes the whole unit. And if Apple were the only company selling phones, that would be a big deal, because you'd want there to be a market.
I agree.
But there are other options, like literally... the other 75% or 80% or 85% of the market is Android phones. So it's a weird thing where it's like,
yeah,
a company controlling its own product is not fundamentally a monopoly. I think the interesting thing about the Google thing, we talked about this on Download today a little bit, is that I feel like Google's open talk is and its open source strategy with Android that it had, especially early on, is coming back to bite it a little bit, because it seems to me that what the EU is kind of asking is basically that Google open up Android and keep it open in a way that it's been trying to kind of lock it down the last few years, in terms of like, you got to have the Google search stuff in order to get access to the App Store. Or one of the ones that they pointed out is that if you're a company that wants to sell some forked smartphones that are not on Google's official Android, but are on some other kind of fork, Google has a policy where they basically blacklist you. They basically say, we won't let you use the Google services and sell those on your phones if you also sell phones that don't have it. Right. And that's really interesting, right? Because that's basically saying, no, you need to provide, you said that this is an open platform, you need to treat it as such. And that's, I mean, one of the weird things about the EU is that they make the they don't tell the company what to do. They just say you need to propose a resolution to this, and we'll tell you if it's good enough, which is fascinating because you got to build your own punishment. But I feel like it is a little bit of that Google bringing the birds home to roost of like, oh yeah, you said this was an open platform, so now you got to make it an open platform again, even though you don't want to do that for lots of business reasons. But then again, there is an advantage, which is if you can, that Google knows, which is having Apple in the market and even having Android forks in the market helps get the scrutiny off of them. And right now they locked it down maybe too much, and now there's more scrutiny on them.
Right. Yeah. And it's always tricky when it comes to these regulations. And obviously the EU has very different viewpoints. Yes. on what this is there instead of the US. I think, you know, there are, I think I'm, you know, I'm with you in the most part, the same argument that like they tried to make this argument with the iPod years ago too, right? Like when it only took iTunes Music, and the answer was, yeah, but it's kind of a, you know, one product. It's like arguing that Sony's PlayStation should play Xbox games, right? Like,
yes, exactly.
That's
right.
That's not how that works.
Exactly.
That's
right. Nintendo has a monopoly on Nintendo games. They don't play on other platforms. It's like, no,
right.
No.
Yeah. So that's just business.
Yeah.
I do think it's a, and I've got a column coming forth on Macworld this week about default apps and why I think that it would be good for Apple to offer that. And I think, in fact, I think it would be good for us users. I think it would be good for developers. And I think it would ultimately be good for Apple, if for no other reason than competition is good. They make better products. They haven't, like, a lot of their apps that are the ones that you can't easily get rid of, or the ones that are most ingrained in the experience, things like Mail and Safari, are the ones that often lie fallow the longest, because there's not a huge impetus for Apple to improve them, right? Like, there is competition. You can go download Chrome.
Yes.
But at the same time, Chrome is never, you know, there are limitations, and you have to jump through hoops, and it requires a certain degree of savvy if you're going to replace Chrome, you know, with Safari in your everyday usage.
And on iOS, Chrome is using WebKit.
Right. So
straight up,
yeah.
Apple's the same WebKit that's in the OS, because you can't build your own browser engine. Yeah, I agree with that to a certain point, although I see Google and Apple and Microsoft in the 90s point of trying to do integration, like, you know, the way that they built their, you know, Mail integration is that Mail is running and it appears in various places when you do, you know, email features. Now, they could build it differently, but then now they're doing like big architectural changes just to allow a third party app thing. And it's like, I don't think they're opposed to it as much as that it's not a high priority for them, because they know the core of their audience doesn't care about all of that.
I mean, it's something that I think most people probably wouldn't bother with. But
my frustration is what you said earlier, which is my frustration. I think this is actually, you know, for all of the criticism Apple gets, and Apple gets a lot of criticism about their keyboards. There's like this week people were freaking out about the i9 being thermally throttled, which I, you know, maybe that'll be a thing. But I looked at that story and I was like, give it 3 weeks and nobody will care about it anymore.
Sorry,
and it will have
all
been...
The story I read about that involved somebody testing it by putting it in a freezer.
Yes.
And I was like, we've gone over the edge.
Yeah, I don't know. I always have said that original MacBook Air worked best in a meat locker. So there is some truth to that. But I think in the end, it's going to not be a thing. Just my guess. It might be, but it probably won't be. What was I going to say? I don't even remember now.
A thing
that people aren't outraged about is the quality of some of the included apps and the complete lack of innovation and attention. And I mean, my guess as an outsider is that they're just not the places where people are excited to work at Apple. And so the engineers who get put on them don't get very many. I'm not saying that they aren't good engineers, but that they don't get very many resources. And so they aren't allowed to do much. Cause like Apple Mail.
Yeah.
I mean, I gotta say it. Like I bought these old Macs and got them up to speed running old versions of OS X. It's like Apple Mail hasn't changed
almost at all.
And in an era where so many interesting ideas about mail management happen in third-party apps, especially on the iPhone, but even some of the stuff that Google is experimenting with and auto replies and things like that, like Apple Mail is just it is like a 15-year-old, 20-year-old piece of software with some, you know, it improves here and there, but basically it's the same concept. And nobody has thought, how could we, nobody at Apple is like, how can we do email better? Instead, they're like,
right.
It's, we solved email. We're moving on. It's like, no, I don't think you did.
It's literally them viewing it as a solved problem. I agree with you 100%. Like, and I think, and part of it may also be as we start to skew younger people coming on board, email is they don't use it as much. And when they do use it, it's viewed as sort of just a necessary evil, right?
And I get,
but like the fact that it's so integral, the fact that we still, somebody pointed out the other day, like that's still kind of our de facto identity service,
right?
Like universal identity
service.
Even
if you don't check your email, you need an email address.
That is messed up when you consider how crappy email is.
And I agree that email is more for the olds than it used to be, and that's fine because I hate email, but the fact is email is a necessary evil for a lot of people. And the fact is there are companies out there that are really trying to do some innovative things in terms of email processing, and Apple is nowhere. And because they are default, they, you know, I would argue that if that Apple is contributing to the kind of like, I don't know, unraveling and, you know, increasingly irrelevance of email, because they're treating it as a solved problem when it's not. Like, there's so many people have had these like email triage systems and stuff that they tried to build in, and Google has done that with Inbox. Like, Google cares about it, but Apple seems to not care about it. And Calendar's the same way. Like, I use Fantastical and it's like Fantastical is way better than the Calendar app. And like, why Fantastical, like, why should that just not be the Calendar app? But that would require some vision about where to take a calendar app. And you know what? The fact is that those are on maintenance mode, essentially. And again, I'm sure the people who are working on them care about them a lot. In fact, I would wager the people who work on them would tell you they want to do stuff like that, and nobody will ever prioritize it. And you know what? You know what would help in that situation is if you could let third-party apps come in and take their place as the default.
That's basically where my article is going, which is I think it would be good for the competition would benefit everybody, because not only would the people who use other apps benefit, but if Apple is forced to respond and innovate in its own stead, then the people who stay on Mail will get better apps as a result.
And if Apple doesn't care and thinks it is a solved problem, it allows them to not be a blocker to
let other people handle it then.
If you're not
interested in it, let people who
get out of the way
take the reins. That's kind of how I feel about that, and I understand it's not high priority, but it would benefit developers, it would benefit Apple, I think, from making apps better, and most of all it would benefit the users who still have to use email after all these years.
I think there are a lot of people using email, even though it's cool. I think there are a lot of people using it.
I
don't love it,
like, I don't either, but like, it's by default, you have to use, there's just no way around it.
No.
There's just, I would be a fascinating experiment to see how far you could get without an email address. My hunch is not very far.
No, I actually, this came up with Jamie because, you know, she needs to have like an Apple ID and she needs to have, and she never uses email, but she has to have an email address. So she has an email address that I set up and she doesn't check it. But she has
I just think about all the stuff I do in email, and even the stuff that is like actual,
out into the business world and things are
a little different.
Although with businesses having things like Slack, maybe that stuff all happens in Slack instead of in
I
email.
Assume too in education, you know, when she goes off to school, like email might become more important.
Although a lot of the education stuff, there are like electronic means. There's like a classroom app or whatever, and
messages and stuff. Wow.
Jason,
I just, out of curiosity, I just scrolled back to my earliest message in Apple Mail because I keep everything in the inbox like a heathen.
No.
2002.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't changed that much, so it's fine.
Nope, it really hasn't. I've been using Apple Mail for 16 years, and it's largely the same. And terrifying.
Oh, good times, good times.
Yep, indeed.
Well, it's good to be back doing the Secret Podcast regularly.
Yeah. Yeah, I know everybody misses us when we go away. I assume.
Okay, you don't know for sure then.
I miss it though, so I'm just projecting on everybody else, I guess.
That works.
They all right, can tell us if they feel differently.
Thanks to everybody for supporting Six Colors and being a subscriber and listening to our podcast. And we will be back next week, I assume. Are you going anywhere? You're fleeing the vicinity?
Not immediately.
You don't
not
have
immediately.
A summer vacation next week?
I do. Not next week. I do in August. I've got a couple trips planned, one of which I believe I'll see you at.
Oh.
Maybe.
Yes, you will.
Back to San Jose.
We'll be a little earlier next week because I have a trip next weekend.
Ooh.
Exciting. But you know, but this is not a podcast to tell you about where we're going to be. But
no,
we'll be.
You can
we'll
tune back. Into you can tune into our other podcast where you can for
yeah,
stalking us,
Dan and Jason's location podcast. But yeah, until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.